So welcome to Caffeinated New Jersey, a show brewed right here inside Cedar Beans Coffee Joint in Cedar Grove, New Jersey, where good conversations always happen as naturally as the coffee pours. Each episode is a seat at the table with artists, makers, and storytellers, digging into what drives them to create and connect. I'm your host, Dave Fletcher. And thanks for spending a little bit of time with us. So today's guest is AJ Scaff, a songwriter, an actor, and a creative Swiss Army knife whose work lives at the intersection of music, film, and storytelling. AJ has worn just about every creative hat there is, front of stage, behind the camera, on the page, and in the studio. His songs feel lived in. His performances feel curious, and his career has been built less around chasing one lane and more around following the pull of whatever story wants to be told next. Today, we're digging into that pull. What sparks it? What sustains it? And where that creative buzz actually comes from when all that noise dies down? AJ? Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
That was quite the apt description of me, too.
Good. I'm glad you like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
It was really good.
The creative Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I you and I have known each other for a little while. You know, I think what I'm more interested in finding out kind of today is a little bit of your background and sort of how you got to where you are now. But a great question to start is, how are you feeling today creatively?
Well, I mean, I worked all day. I work in a set shop. Here in Jersey, not far away from the coffee shop there. And so we put in fairly long days, not as long as, say on a film, but if we do overtime, like today almost was, it's a very long day. Creatively, I get a lot of that energy out working in the shop. And I find that actually physically laboring at almost anything, cutting a lawn actually helps me to think about writing and about songs. I mean, it's like Carole King wrote Locomotion while she was vacuuming her house. So as you hear rhythms from machines or other stuff coming in and out of your ears, there are rhythms everywhere that just kind of get you going. And so I, you know, there's times I will stop actually at work, whatever I'm doing, and write something down or put it into my phone, just for later, you know, just you find little ideas as you go along throughout a day. And they generally will, self-realize themselves as a story you may want to pursue, or you're just jotting something down to add to the pile that you may use later, or you revisit it. I mean, I've found songs and things I've jotted down previously I had totally forgotten about, and that set off a whole new idea. You know, and so I indulge that and follow that. I generally don't have a set discipline. I depend a lot on serendipity almost, you know. Mm-hmm. There are times where there's topical things I've written, especially recently. Not all of it's I'm putting effort into. It's just to get rid of anxiety or nervous energy or a way of trying to understand a situation. So it doesn't necessarily even have to become a song or a poem. There are times where I just write poems.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to become a song. That was one of the things I really loved about songwriting was in school. I think it was high school where no, it was like seventh or eighth grade. We had a music teacher that explained to us how Bob Dylan especially was writing poetry that he put to words. And that a lot of, if you look at a lot of really good lyrics to really good songs, it's because they're more like poetry than they are just simply as radio fodder, you know, words in a song on the radio. And so it kind of elevated things for me. And I already liked poetry because it's so concise. And it forces you to clarify and play with language as well. And so being a little ADD, maybe, a kid that was constantly active, for me, poetry helps me focus. But because you have to keep things short, I can get that energy out and then calm down, you know, much quicker. So mm-hmm. It is a kind of therapy for me too. Creative things are.
You talked about being a kid and having somebody give you that insight into Dylan and where'd you live in New Jersey now, but where did you grow up?
Yeah. I did grow up in Cedar Grove, there in Cedar Grove.
Okay.
And until I had a car, I ran everywhere. I literally ran everywhere. Hiked everywhere, just all over the place. Couldn't sit still kind of kid. Always wanted to have adventures. That was another thing. There was always a thing in me to seek out things, meet people, food, go face to face with historic places, all of that stuff. And, probably a lot of that came from my mom, whereas my love of music came from my dad, very much so.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah. Okay. I got a little brother and a little sister.
Creative people?
Yes, in their own ways.
Okay. How so?
Very much so. Like my sister will do very family-oriented things. If something needs to be made for school, she's on it. She can organize your vacation down to like the minutes, when you'll arrive, all that stuff. But she can make things. Like every year she would make a gingerbread house through the night. She's more of a night owl than I am. My little brother loves to cook. That's his thing. He was a guitar player for a little bit. Kind of got to move in the circles with My Chemical Romance, those guys.
They're a bit on the local side, right?
Yeah. And he only did that briefly. And then it wasn't kind of his thing to live that sort of artistic life. And he became a really good mechanic and works real hard and all that. I mean, and that's the thing is that's a very common thing with all of us is just work. Take plenty of vacations and all that stuff, but or downtime at least. But yeah, there's my mom's side of the family is more the creative side, whereas my dad's side was athletic and such, more on the business side of things type stuff.
Right.
So
did you and you said your brother played guitar? Is that, and he's younger, so Did you kind of give him the love of guitar? Did you both kind of pick it up at the same time? Did you, you know, did you play together? Did you write together?
No, not at all. He is 18 years younger than me.
Okay.
So by the time he would become old enough, I was already, I had taken off for the West and Montana at that point.
What brought you to Montana?
Still fairly, you know,
what made you leave to go to Montana? You left Cedar Grove and you're like, I'm going to Montana. Moving to Montana soon. You're gonna be, were you gonna be a dental floss tycoon? What was the plan?
That's right. Yeah, that was it. It was a big dream with a tiny pony. It was kind of happenstance and a strange little story about that. After I graduated high school, you know, I'm bouncing around trying to find a job and do like be the good kid and just get a job and be a regular guy, even though I'd really rather be in a rock band. But I really had no concept how people went off to become musicians, known musicians and all that. That would, even to this day, that's a weird thing. Like, I don't know how people do that necessarily. So I'm just muddling through it now. And I pretty much figure that's, I'm realizing that's pretty much how everybody does it. But so I got into real estate for a bit. I got myself a license and I sent away for information in the back of, I think it was Boys Life magazine, maybe, or Outside magazine. And they were selling land out in Montana for really cheap. And at the time, to me, it wasn't really cheap. And so they the pamphlet gets there. Anyway, I kind of forget about it. And I keep trying to work and be a regular person. I try to look normal amongst all the other normal people. And got out to Montana. Moved out there with an ex-girlfriend. She was an ex-girlfriend at the time. Still a very good friend of mine now.
And you're how old right now?
At that point, I was 29 when we moved out there. I turned 30, actually, after we landed there. And at some point, not long after moving out there, I decided I'm going to clean out this little file box of mine. And in there is that pamphlet. That pamphlet was selling land in the very town we happened to move to. I had no idea. None whatsoever. Yeah, it was really weird. Now, by the time we got out there, the land was now going for like, I think at the time they were selling 20 acres for $2,000, which is like unheard of, because by the time we got out there, you could buy 1 acre for $20,000, and now it's a bunch more money out there. And eventually, over time, I'd start working in the movies out there, and playing a little bit, some of the open mics and things like that. And worked in movies long enough and found my place in that, but it was really difficult to make a living at it out there. Despite what an awesome crew we had, I just had to make the decision after a divorce. And once my kids were out of the house, I was like, I have to move back east. I know the terrain. I know I can play music here and do go somewhere with that. And so, yeah, I moved back here. I now build sets for TV and film, on all the shows that you see and all this stuff. But yeah, more and more I've been focusing on getting my music going and such like that. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, no, it did. So you were in Montana and you said you were working for some movie productions. I'm just trying to see the connection. You know, you're a musician, you move out there with your your girlfriend or your ex-wife, you said your girlfriend, I think, and you're out there and you're there for about how long?
I ended up out there for about, I think it was 28 years. So at the by the time I moved back, it was literally half of my life out there.
All right. So
So
you're
there.
in you're in Montana, you're writing music. Did you put a band together out there? You said you were doing some open mics.
I made a couple of attempts at trying to put a band together and get some recordings done, but it's in places like that, it's really tricky. Your
Is there a
artistic
scene?
pool,
Is there like
yeah,
a
there
scene in
is.
Montana?
I mean,
Okay.
there is a good music scene.
What year
The
is this?
music, what's that?
What year is this then
What?
you, that you're in Montana? I mean, you told
I
me
moved out
the
there.
span.
I moved there in 92.
So is it kind of like the back end of grunge? Like still, is it happening out there or is
No.
it? Okay.
No,
What
we
kind of
got
music?
there was a lot of bluegrass, country,
Okay.
folk, mostly dominated things. Those styles, and they're great, and they're lots of fun to play. I mean, I totally appreciate going to the open mics and hearing everybody playing or go see shows, friends shows. We would have bands that would come through, like regular rock bands, and they would do well. We don't have huge venues. I think the Bobcat Stadium over in Bozeman was the biggest one, but I think the acoustics in there, people said, were really awful, so I never went to a show there.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, folks were mostly in their own little bands, and those bands were generally in the genres I wasn't playing in. And I think everybody was kind of pretty comfortable just being playing locally. I think, you know, I don't know everybody's backstory. For all I know, they just had decent jobs and or they were really good ski bums. God bless the ski bums. And so they were pretty content, whereas again, I'm not content with just playing locally. I really still to this day like traveling. I like being the idea of being on the road, and all the mess, and it's very messy. It's very expensive to have a band on the road, or, you know, or a film, whatever. But that is the kind of life that attracts me. I don't like it when it's like re actually messy. There's a difference between, you know, a hot mess of drugs and alcohol going down the road partying in a band van. Whereas I like to run things more in a business like way, I guess. You know, so everybody's taken care of, everybody's safe. But we're having fun. I mean, I don't. It should be so everybody's enjoying their job. Okay, I think that's the best way to put it. And
Okay.
so, I don't appreciate people, anyone, whether it's the crew or the band, you know, going to get chemically all messy and all that stuff.
Sure.
I mean,
Sure.
as a 20-something, I did that, but
Right.
Lord knows. So, yeah, after a while, I thought, you know, I'll move back to the New York City area, the New Jersey, North Jersey, New York City area, and it's a very different place somewhat these days. It's still vibrant, but you know, you remember the Aquarian newspaper? That was always a great read. And you could always pick up, you know, find out where shows were and everything like that. You know, these days, a lot of things are seem to be dispersed all over the internet, and it's kind of tricky to find a good source, you know, to find the bands, go to the shows. And I have a lot of friends, whether they're in sound or in a band, that are playing gigs and all over the state. You know, there's sort of a hotbed of players down the shore, as well as up here in North Jersey, but not in the western part so much where I am. They're more, everybody's still closer to the city. And so it's kind of tricky finding rehearsal spaces, you know, and all that stuff these days. And but it's still something you can get very much get done here. Don't get me wrong. And, you know, mainly because it's where we are here, you know, the New York City area, the Northeast region. Whereas in Montana, we were kind of landlocked, you know, the bands, the town I lived in Livingston, we had even fewer choices of players, all good. But, you know, there was a bigger pool over in Bozeman, but those, like I said, mainly everybody had their own bands. So, and their own hangouts and things like that. And at open mics, you could hear some wildly interesting stuff. You know, I saw a mandolin player with a distortion pedal play one night, and he was great. Uh-huh. He was fantastic. Everybody, of course, loves to play all the big hits from the radio, the classic rock stuff, or do unusual versions of hits. And then there's, you know, all the original players like myself that would get up there too. And so it was fun. I mean, maybe I just didn't know how to go about getting something done in Montana. And we were very limited because of the weather. You know, during the winter time, if you weren't out of there and playing somewhere else in warmer climes, you were kind of snowbound, sort of, you know. So, but yeah. Whereas here, so, you know, you can sort of do things different.
So you get back to Jersey. What, when you sit down to write, what pushes you there?
If I'm sitting down to write, it's because the idea has such urgency in it that I can't let go, and I have to sit down and work it out.
Is it
so?
It,
I can't. Yes. It's what? Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah, there's. I can't let go. There you go. I describe it as going into this room, and you go and learn about the character. And, or characters, or the situation. It can be a situation. And you're not only, you know, exploring that world in that room, but, you know, you're working within a sort of confines, which at times I don't abide by. I lean on my old poetry rules, from high school that I learned. And
which were?
So I will, what's that?
What were the rules?
Well, of course, I mean, you've got rhyming, you've got meter, you know, like Shakespeare had iambic pentameter. And so you can, or haiku has the 757 or 575 is one of the patterns for haiku. And so I will at times use poetry rules like that. And of course you're, you know, do you rhyme line A and B, or do you go A, B, and then C, or, you know, what have you? There have been times, Alice Cooper is a great example of, School's Out for Summer, where they can't think of a a line to rhyme is the end of one of the verses. And it was great because he's playing with language there. You're expecting, you know, a rhyme at the end of the line. And he's just like, can't think of a line to rhyme. And it was great. So I, you know, during his Beatles psychedelic period, especially, would play with language. Almost like taking parts and pieces of things and ideas and hiding whole stories inside of that. And like, you literally have to know John Lennon to know certain words, certain phrases and things like that. The Rolling Stones, I can't think of the song. They wrote phrases on pieces of paper and they just threw them down and then picked one at a time. And that's how they assembled the lyrics on the song. I forget. It's off of Exile on Main Street. Can't think of the song. So number one, I like to play with language, sometimes within rules. And then other times, you want to just, like in a Bob Dylan sort of way, let's say, really stretch the meaning of words to say the same thing, but in a weird way or in an odd way. You know, when dissidents under dictatorships are writing, they will play with language in order that they don't get in trouble. I think it was during the Dark Ages where musicians weren't allowed to use dissonant chords because those were the devil's chords. So they had to use, you know,
right,
proper chords and things, but they would, mm-hmm, slip them in as, and the excuse would be, well, we have to resolve this and turn it around, or, you know, so it's not the devil in there and we're okay. And
that's probably so where the phrase, the devil made me do it, came from.
Yeah, so
the devil made you do it.
The devil. Yeah. So when I'm playing the devil's music or writing the devil's music, so I will play with language that way. You know, it's not always simple, like Robert Frost will write lyrics in his poems, his verses and such, or Shakespeare with his iambic pentameter. And Shakespeare, you know, was inventing words to make that meter work. And I mean, it's words, 25,000 words he added to language. And it's words we still use to this day, phrases we use to this day, like the devil made me do it or something. Mm-hmm. So there's so much potential and possibility to help you write that there isn't just one way you can do it. And when you write, like to express the mood, to like add layers to its meaning, sometimes you will write in a certain way. You know, you wouldn't write psychedelia with proper sentences. You wouldn't, mm-hmm, get it across, you know?
Right.
So you wouldn't have the Eggman in sentences. So you use language and explore words to make them yours. And like an artist will use color and a palette to tell two layers to a story, the many layers to a story, like Picasso's, his painting about the bombing, the huge black and white painting that he did. Oh, I can't think of the title of the painting, but he made everything in just black and white. And it was intended to be like that. Yes, there is color when, obviously, when people are being bombed to death and such. But there's an intention in using a certain color palette. So you do the same thing with your music, with your lyrics, how you write those lyrics, how you construct the music and the mood for that. And so that's what I have in mind when I'm writing. Unless I'm writing just a straightforward song, like say my song Empty Chair is a song where it was pretty much straightforward. I wanted it to get across the story about this guy, this single guy, but it didn't have to be all too crazy or too deeply meaningful. But then there's other songs I've written where I write them in such a way that if you're paying attention to, you know, how the lines work, you should get another meaning out of it and how I used words and such. So I do try to remain cognizant of that stuff. It's a very intentional thing. Most of the time, that allows me to write. So, but I have learned, but you're always learning too. When mm-hmm. you're writing, you're learning how to write better. Always. The lead singer from the Canadian band who passed away from brain cancer. Oh, I can't think of their
Gord Downie. Tragically.
Yeah. Hit. Gord Downie. He was really starting to play with language. I mean, just wonderful stuff. Absolutely wonderful stuff. And when you apply it to the music, it just elevates. Mm-hmm. You know, opera, I've come to really appreciate opera because of that. Mm-hmm. And classical music, I've always liked classical music, but lately I've gotten to understand it on a more deeper level. And jazz is fantastic for creating moods and tapestries that are incredibly rich, especially on the musical side of things. Coltrane was phenomenal. Thelonious Monk, both of them were just masterful at weaving notes and beats and rests in such an incredible way. And there's lots of rock bands. There's so many rock bands. I mean, you know, with Jethro Tull, you're a big fan of Jethro Tull and what they do with music.
As should everybody be. Yes.
I made you gush, didn't I?
You did.
Yeah. I mean, the way progressive rock bands, and still today, progressive bands, they make full use of the language, the scope of music, and words too. Rush is obviously a very well-known band for their lyrics and their musicianship, and creating whole worlds inside of, you know, a single album. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, what I'm writing now is very different than what I had previously been writing. I didn't necessarily want to explore music I was previously writing too much. It wasn't an area I wanted to go. I became more enamored of the punk and the rock music and the radio friendly stuff recently. And so I very much got that recorded on my new EP. And I mean, in time, I have other ideas that I want to explore, which are more towards, it's sort of genre bending. I still love playing my acoustic guitar. I write everything on it, my Taylor, and I want to see what can be done with an acoustic guitar, because nobody expects, when I show up with an acoustic guitar, the impression I get at least, they're expecting country music or bluegrass or something like that, you know. And I like showing, I want to use that guitar along with electrics and keyboards and horns and see more where words and lyrics can go, and not just stay in one place, you know. You know, so yeah, that's the kind of stuff I think about a lot. I mean, throughout a night, here's something fun. I wake up every day with at least one song, one chunk of music playing in my head.
Something that you're envisioning, or a song for yourself.
Yeah, probably like 90% of the material that comes out of that, like, wakes me up in the day, or I wake up with, is original. Now, trying to capture that,
yeah,
is tricky.
Where does that muse live? I mean, is it in your subconscious then, is what you're saying? You know, some people have described, you know, a muse as, somebody that they know or they're in love with, or their instrument itself. But you're saying you're feeling stuff in your subconscious, you awake, and it's been manifesting itself during your REM sleep, I guess.
Not, there's times where it's in my dreams, but it's towards the end of the dream, just as I'm waking.
Credits of your dream.
And scene. So I don't sleep through a night, so this will happen twice in a night. So, you know, whenever it is I wake up, it could be anywhere between midnight and 3 a.m. And there's generally that first time I wake up, there's generally not that much going on. But it's when I get back to sleep and wake up that immediately there's something there. There's music, whether it's, you know, another band's music. I mean, I've dreamed music that is original, but as if The Who were doing it, or as if Hootie and the Blowfish, or what was the other one? Crowded House. There was one, I got one down from Crowded House, and one from like a Hootie and the Blowfish kind of style. I still have the lyrics to those songs. But The Who, I mean, I've had The Who, I've had 80s like metal band, hair metal music in my head. I've woken up with three different songs in my head. That was a tricky one. Like, one song started and I'm like, wow, that's really good. And then it went to another. Oh, that's really good too. And I was trying to like not completely wake up so I could like creep out of the bed and get to my guitar and see if I could figure it out. And by the time you do that, it's like when you get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you're like, oh, I'm awake now. Yay. But every so often you can capture, you know, one of those songs.
So look, you've worked in music, film, theater, you've worked behind the scenes as well. And it's interesting, actually, I don't want to get too deep into some sort of a psychological, unpacking here, that you're having dreams and the closing credits, you know, are songs. But with all those types of mediums that you've been in, does each one, you don't have to get too detailed in this, but what is each one of those different things that you do give you that the others don't?
Can you ask that again?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So You're clearly a musician, a songwriter, a poet. You've also worked in theater. You've worked in front of the camera, behind the camera. What does each one of those things, those different things, what do they give you that the others don't?
The other jobs?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, there has to be something in building sets that gives you some sort of creative kind of juice that songwriting doesn't, or you wouldn't do it. You'd do something else, I'm assuming. I'm kind of curious as to what these different things that you do gives you that the other one doesn't.
When it comes to, well, when I worked in Montana, it wasn't unusual for me to build everything start to finish. In other words, if you needed something, if you need something built here, I had to choose to be a carpenter and only a carpenter. So we build the structure, the armature, whatever, the under skeleton to whatever you'll see on film or on TV. And the scenics then are brought in and they finish off the look. They give it the look. Most times, I mean, there's a rare time or two where we do some of the stuff that's more on the artistic side. But when I was in Montana, I did everything start to finish. Mm. I would even at times help with the design and or be just given the assignment of, let's say, like, oh, the telephone booth. I had to build a telephone booth, an old-fashioned telephone booth. And I built that whole thing start to finish from scratch. Painted it, gave it the look and everything like that. Because we didn't have scenics on it. It was a very small film. And there were times where I would build a thing and then have to, like, distress it, make it look aged and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I would have to do everything in the art department at times. I mean, there is one film I did, I got a production designer credit for it, but I made everything in the film. I was the entire art department from the top all the way down. And until we went out filming on the road for a little bit, it was just me. And then I brought in an assistant for a brief amount of time, but that was about it. Whereas here, to answer your question, the building, I'd rather work on sets and props, things like that, than
why
to have to be on a job site.
Got it. Okay.
I don't mind building houses. I really don't. I'm just not, and there's so many of us that we're just, after a while, you're killing yourself on a job site, especially if you're the contractor. I was a contractor for a bit, a couple of times actually. And there's a ton of stuff you have to juggle. And there's so much, there's so many things coming at you that make it uncomfortable. And it's not as romantic. Like, you can get caught up in building the same old house over and over again. It's not my thing. It's just not my thing. People build very differently these days too, so that it's almost cookie cutter, and that's not attractive to me. The arts are more attractive to me because it flexes my brain. It tickles it. You have to be thinking. Now, being a little ADD, there's times I'm thinking over there when I should be here at my work table, more present. But I'm still building stuff generally that's more interesting with sets. So, yeah, I mean, And then with music, I mean, I just get to do anything I want. It's my music.
Right. Right. You know? So I'm guessing that it's part of this is the physicality of building is use a different part of your brain in your toolkit than writing poetry or you know strumming your guitar. There's a different part of your brain that needs to be satisfied. You know, I understand that in more ways than probably, you know, my background in graphic design and creative arts, when I got the opportunity to build a coffee shop, it allowed me to get my hands dirty, and my hands needed to be dirty. Using your one part of your brain all the time makes the other part get weak. So I think that in your case, you know, you're constantly trying to strive to satisfy your creative itch, whether it's through physical labor to create that, even not wanting to repeat yourself, you know, has a lot to do with a real sharp kind of creative mind. And, you know, also your interest in a lot of different genres of music, or dreaming in, you know, psychedelia one night versus, arguably, you know, decent kind of pop writing in Hootie and the Blowfish or whatever the next night. So you've got all these ways that you're sort of satisfying your buzz. You know, has it disappeared ever? And if it did, how did you respond?
That's a really good question. So I'm not always working at something. Like, I can go every day to work in the set shop. I'm mm-hmm. not in charge of it. All I have to do is show up and do that. And then, because of that, it sort of, it gives me time away from my guitar, from writing. I still have music. I mean, we have headphones we all wear, and or somebody's got a boombox playing really loud. But I've learned that the physical stuff keeps me occupied while I'm literally taking a physical break, not necessarily mental break, from the stuff I really like to do. Like, I live in fear, I almost live in fear, of making a living as a musician and an artist, because I have nothing giving me a break. Like, I would have to go work in the yard. I would have to, like, go repair some things and take a break. Because I need a break from the creativity too, at this, like, fully dedicated creativity. I can walk away from my guitar and pick it up days later, and it sounds like a whole other instrument to me again. And so I hear the same chords that I will generally always go to in a very different way. I'll play them in a different way. They'll have, you know, because of that different attack, I have fresh new ears. And so I will start playing with ideas on the guitar. And suddenly I have two or three ideas for new songs. And it could be the same group of chords from another song of mine. I've noticed that there's sort of a pattern to that with a lot of musicians, a lot of rock, you know, mass appeal musicians and such. I mean, there's only so many chords to play with anyway. You know, Quincy Jones said, you got 12 notes to play with. What are you going to do with those 12 notes? And you can perpetually, almost infinitely play with those, and it will result in new music, you know? So it doesn't bother me if I'm taken away from being creative. I mean, there's painting and drawing I do that really hyper-focuses me. But there's a point where it starts to stress me out. Whereas
yeah, I was going to say,
stress me out in writing, you know, doesn't stress me out.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you protect that creativity from turning into obligation?
Yeah, that's a very real fear. I mean, you can see that there's some musicians or artists even who run straight into a wall, and they're not necessarily being creative. I don't want to, I mean, in private, I can tell you some of my opinions, but I feel really bad because there are really good musicians out there that you can see they might not know to take a break from things. And so maybe they turn to drugs or something. I don't know, because they think that'll help. I don't know. But
drugs are an escape. I think that,
drugs are sort of
helps them
escape.
Get away. Yeah. I mean, unless you're dealing with psychedelics, which, you know, arguably probably was helpful in producing most of the good stuff that came out of the late 60s and early 70s. You know, most of the, let's not say good stuff. Let's say innovative stuff, because I don't think that you would have had a lot of the innovation that now is, sort of second nature to musicians. Those doors wouldn't have been open, you know, without that kind of stuff. But I get your point. I get your point totally that, you know, some people just kind of check out, you know,
But some of them, you know, rise above it. Some of them go in and then come out of it, you know, because if you work at it, you know, you'll somewhere along the way, you have a better chance of figuring out how to get out of it than if you just give up, you know, and you can't give up. That's another thing. I mean, these days, nothing has changed for me except that I need to know how to make a living at this. I need to figure out how to make a living at this. You know, there are certain aspects of this I'm just not going to try to be great at, you know? And that's more on the business side of things, but I understand the business side of things. You should always know the business side of things. Otherwise, you know, you may meet the wrong person and they'll come in and take everything. I'm trying to remember, like, your question was there.
Well, protecting creativity from turning into obligation. Yeah.
Yeah. I all of those things are equally important, but to make it an obligation, I don't know how to answer that because I don't feel I personally feel obligated, and that's what drives me. But if it's like a business obligation thing, that would have to be a thing for another day. If my project actually gets off the ground and up and running, and a lot of people have said that I've spoken to personally. I mean, I know the founder of one rock band that did very well, but they just blew apart. But hearing from him how things were, you got to be really careful. I mean, they were balls to the wall, million selling records, lots of concerts, world tours, the whole thing. And the pressure just, I mean, they were just musicians and young, and people just pulled them in every direction. The Clash even talk about how people were whispering in their ears, you know, pulling them this way and that way. And, you know, you gotta, there's a lot you gotta be responsible for. Once, you know, your little music project becomes, starts to become this behemoth, this Leviathan, you know, and so you got to get actually a little more serious as you get into this. And so it becomes this whole other thing, you know. Big credit to Taylor Swift running her world the way she does. She's fantastic. Sure. I think I don't necessarily, I'm not a big fan of her music, but I'm completely impressed by how she's running her world.
She owns it.
Still
man.
Remaining.
She owns
what's
it.
That?
She owns she does. It. Like the it with the capital I and the capital T. I mean, she owns
totally.
All of it.
And she still comes off as a very brilliant, natural, wonderful person.
There's probably a lot of work that goes into that, but yes, there's a lot of effort.
I mean, when
to
you
remain
deal with
normal,
people,
yeah.
Dealing with so many different personalities, even in your day-to-day, my day-to-day, anyone's, we know what that is. And then you multiply that times millions of people and the expectations from some people. I mean, the barriers you have to put up, the barricades, you know, the personal space has to become a solid tank of armor. Still permeable, but still, you know, wisely constructed and I suppose dispersed amongst everyone.
Right.
I mean, it's got to be something else, you know. I mean, everybody has said it's like nobody prepares you for success, so I'm not even going to try to say, oh, I know just what I'll do. when it becomes an obligation.
Yeah. So look, if you personally, I'm kind of going to dig into your head a little bit as we sort of kind of wrap this up. If you strip away all of the things that make you, you, right? Music, film, performance, live performance in a studio.
Right.
What still needs to be expressed? If you take everything away, what still needs to be expressed?
The writer and the writer and I can't think of the words here. It's a message, a messenger. There's a part
of me. What's the messenger? Who's the messenger at that point?
There's a part of me. And I didn't realize my dad, towards the end of his life, said to me, you're the happiest person I've ever met. And now lately, as I've gotten older, I've become definitely jaded, a little sharper than I should be at times. The purpose of my music, the stuff that I want to get across is part of the messenger type thing, is people have to take a breath in this life and realize you're not taking your favorite t-shirt. You're not taking that pile of money. You're not taking that car. Nothing. You're simply here, no more importantly than a grasshopper or a tree. You are, as Carl Sagan put it, you are, this is very loosely paraphrasing, you are the universe becoming conscious of itself. Okay? So I think people need to just learn to take a breath and be happy. Take away the labels. Experience joy. Relax. You know, face, you got to face down yourself. First and foremost, you can't go around judging people. If you're going around judging people in certain contexts, it's probably because it's something in you you don't like, and you're not enjoying life maybe to the fullest. I mean, there are people to judge in this world when people are misbehaving, and you know, without question, they're doing nothing according to the golden rule, nothing according to the social contract. And for what? For what? You know, nobody's taking anything with them when they leave here. You know, enjoy it. Not because of judgment later on. Enjoy it because you're here. You're lucky to be here. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I'm trying to get that kind of across. You know, you put on a show, you get everybody to like let go themselves, mm-hmm. and have fun. And, you know, if you want to start writing songs, cool, start writing some songs. I'd love to hear your songs. Everybody has a song in them, at least one. I want to hear it. Mm-hmm. So that's what this is. I spent a good part of my life trying to be the good boy. And now I'm just like, no, I'm just going to, I want to end my life being an artist and a musician. That's it. We don't need to go around destroying the planet and acquiring insane amounts of money, you know, for what? For what? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with it? Look at everything in history. None of that stuff lasts. You know, if you ever saw during COVID, how animals were just running all over places that they didn't normally because everybody was in lockdown. Mm. All the noise had stopped. And so animals started just going places, and nature will replace us. If you've ever seen abandoned ruins, nature just starts pushing right back through, as if we weren't ever there. So that's kind of the messenger aspect of me.
Last question. All right.
Go.
This is a good one. Right.
Okay. Right.
So your creativity, the creative buzz, where does it come from now? And how is it different from when you started back in, you know, Cedar Grove originally, before you moved to Montana?
I've had adventures. I've made mistakes. I've taken chances. You know, when I was a kid, I was very cognizant of the fact that you had to go get experiences. You could read plenty of books. I read plenty of books. But you can't just become an amazing writer or person just by reading some books. You can become an amazing person by becoming yourself, not listening to others, because there's only one of you. And so now I'm this person who, you know, I'm polite, well-mannered, but I'm going to call you out. If you're not being a nice person, you're not, you know, it's, I want to be a person that felt good while they were here in the world. Whether or not I have a soul that comes back or goes somewhere, as long as I was true to myself, and I face up to, you know, mistakes I've made or maybe people I've hurt, I don't think I'll be judged as harshly as if I just let my life go because I was so sticking to certain rules that what would you call that? It's just being a good boy, a good little girl, a good person, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. just not troubling anybody. You know, I went there and learned, fortified and enriched my soul, you might say. And so I think that would be it. That's sort of the answer.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, that's...
Listen, yeah. I don't want to cut you off. Keep going.
No, I mean, just as an artist, that's what I think everybody's an artist in that way. You know, nobody's a Democrat or Republican or communist or socialist, whatever. You're just human beings trying to figure things out, you know?
Yeah.
So I just want to be a nice, happy human.
Well, you certainly have expressed that in this conversation for sure. Listen, I got to ask you one question that has nothing to do with, well, it has a little bit in looking at your bio. You redesigned and built the world's largest dinosaur at the Fernbank Museum.
Yeah.
Like how did that happen? Like a dinosaur, the world's this is the world's largest dinosaur.
That was awesome because that was one of the first jobs I ever wanted, was to be a paleontologist. And then I discovered film, and then I wanted to be in film when I was like 10. I was working at a tiny little museum in Livingston, Montana, and the paleo artist that actually ran his studio and then consequently set up this little museum also did a lot of the animals for the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, as well as other places in the world. And he was only one of like 7 paleo artists because there isn't a program where you can get accredited as a paleo artist. So you have to have 2 different disciplines and kind of combine them and then make a business out of it. So I worked for them. I volunteered. And we worked a lot with the Chinese dinosaurs and everything. And the woman in charge, the manager of the little museum, brought myself and another woman down there with her because we had worked a lot with those dinosaurs. And we got down there and to Atlanta, and we found out that the entire dinosaur was solid steel. If you can imagine, it's a piece of steel. I think it was 1.5 inches thick, 2 feet wide by 18 inches wide, or 2 feet long, 18 inches wide, which is extraordinarily heavy. So we were all just kind of freaked out after a while, like, we're not going to be able to stand this up safely. Somebody's going to get killed. And so I volunteered because I have some architecture training in my background, schooling. And I said, get me to the art supply store and I'll sit in my hotel room and draft it out. And I did. And then I got put in charge of watching all the cuts because I wasn't a welder. And so I was watching over the crew, making sure all cuts were correct. Yeah, I couldn't tell you if the welds were correct. And we had an engineer that checked everything. And he changed nothing. Everything I had worked out, you know, was good. And so it's been standing since 2000, year 2000. Yeah. So 26 years. I wrote my name on it. My kids' names were on it. One was still in utero. And the other was a little toddler. But they're buried under the bones there. So that's how it went. That was the short story on that.
Okay. Well, AJ Scaff, thank you so much for sharing your journey. It was really like interesting. Like I said, I've known you for a while, but getting, this into your kind of, creative process, I think is something that normally it takes years to extract that out of somebody. I know you released an EP. So
Yeah.
where can people get the EP? Like what's what are the access points to that?
So if people go to Bandcamp, you look up AJ Scaff and the Bandolets, you can hear the songs there. It's a 7-song EP. I had artwork done up for it by Rick Mann and George Siegel. So each song has its own individual bit of artwork,
Yeah, it's really cool.
that are, thank you, sort of in the style of like dime store novels, film noir, graphic novel
Pulp
type
fiction
stuff,
type stuff.
pulp fiction
Yeah,
type stuff.
yeah.
My cousin's oil painting artwork, he's a fantastic artist, Daryl George. He's the cover. Once I may have physical CDs of this. He's the cover art on there. And yeah, I had fantastic musicians on it and producer. But yeah, there is one thing, and I might actually answer one of your questions that I kind of veered off from, was music, for some reason, like I said earlier, music was something I couldn't understand how to get into, but every time I played music, it goes well. It's like one of the jobs where it seems to work. That's why other things are secondary. But I think that, I want to just kind of stick that in there that, yeah, music seems to work out for me, but the one thing obviously would be me holding me back, but not understanding how like you get forward on things. It's tricky because I mean I had a lawyer try to steal a bunch of my songs and a contract, so that made me step away for a bit too. But yeah, that's I think that answers one of your questions, in a way. So
All
there,
right.
yeah,
Well, there we go.
Bandcamp is the place to go. For my music.
All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Dave. You're awesome. I'll see you soon
You're
for
awesome.
coffee.
Okay.
All
Bye.
right, later.